This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with the author of an article titled Operation Libya and the Battle for Oil, Redrawing the Map of Africa.
If the Battle of Libya is a humanitarian operation, I'm the President of the United States.
We'll talk about a recent report by the Community Service Society on unemployment among young African American men.
Can you believe that only 1 in 4 young black men in New York City has a job? And that's a trend that we see throughout the country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights. On occasion, we here at Law and Disorder tell jokes, particularly lawyer jokes. Well, here's one that we heard a couple of years ago, but it just came across my desk again from a cigar smoker, one of our hosts, Michael Smith. The title of the joke is Best True Lawyer Story of the Year, Decade and Possibly the Century. This took place in Charlotte, North Carolina. A lawyer purchased a box of very rare and expensive cigars, then insured them against, among other things, fire.
Within a month, having smoked his entire stockpile of these great cigars, the lawyer filed a claim against the insurance company. In his claim, the lawyer stated the cigars were lost in a, quote, series of small fires. The insurance company refused to pay, citing the obvious reason, that the man had consumed the cigars in the normal fashion. The lawyer sued, and he won. Stay with me here. What happened, Michael?
Delivering the ruling, the judge agreed with the insurance company that the claim was frivolous. However, the judge stated that the lawyer held a policy from the company in which it had stated that the cigars were insurable and also guaranteed that would it insure them against fire without defining what is considered to be unacceptable fire, and therefore was obligated to pay the claim. Rather than endure lengthy and costly appeals processes, the insurance company accepted the ruling, paid, listen to this one, $15,000 to the lawyer for the loss of his cigars that perished in the, quote, fires.
After the lawyer cashed the check, the insurance company had him arrested on 24 counts of arson. With his own insurance claim and testimony from the previous case being used against him, the lawyer was convicted of intentionally burning his insured property and was sentenced to 24 months in jail and a $24,000 fine. This is a true story. It won first place in last year's Criminal Lawyers Award contest, only in America.
Well, it starts from a problem of spending $15,000 for cigars. Now, you would never do that, Michael, right? You know, on occasion, we also bring attention to the Armenian genocide that occurred in the Ottoman Empire, Turkey in particular. And, of course, as our listeners know, Heidi is half Armenian.
Michael, the Center for Armenian Remembrance, they're based in California, has just sued the Federal Reserve under the Freedom of Information Act, seeking information on its acquisition of a large amount of Armenian gold looted by the Ottoman government way back in 1915.
Now, what I understand happened, the genocide happened, they killed hundreds of thousands of Armenians. I mean, it's a huge genocide. They then took the possessions of the Armenians. The Ottoman Empire took them and somehow got, at that time, $5 million worth of gold. What did they do with it? What did the Ottoman Empire do with it?
Michael, I heard it was about $22 million, okay. Now, of course, worth much, much more, hundreds of millions.
Okay, so they took the money, and then the Ottoman Empire has hold of it. And then, of course, they lose the war. They lose the First World War.
Apparently, the Turkish treasury put the looted Armenian gold first in German Deutsche Bank in Istanbul. In 1916, the gold was transferred to the Bleichroder Bank in Vienna, and then it was moved to the German Central Bank in Berlin and deposited in the account of the Ottoman public debt. At the end of World War I, when the Allied powers demanded reparations from Germany and its Ottoman-Turkish ally, German officials agreed to turn over to the Allies the Armenian gold held by the Reichsbank.
Okay, hold up right there. So what we have is gold stolen from
Armenian
people who were murdered. hundreds of thousands of them in a genocide.
Right.
It's taken by the Ottoman Empire. They lose the First World War. They then, to pay their debt to the winners of the war, France and Great Britain, they take this stolen money and they in part pay their debt with money stolen from murdered Armenians.
Exactly. Instead of returning the Armenian gold to its original owners, Britain and France sold it to the U.S. government through J.P. Morgan Bank in Paris by exchanging it for U.S. Treasury certificates.
So that means
it's now here.
It's now in the United States
somewhere.
Federal
Reserve.
Right.
Exactly.
They've taken this money that belonged to your ancestors and conceivably relatives as well.
Could be some of my money,
yes,
right.
Yes, could be. And we now have it in Fort Knox or somewhere like that, where we have all this gold bricks or whatever form they're in, sitting there that really belong to the victims of the Armenian genocide. So we're trying to find out about
that. But something good happened. On January 29th, 1925, Senator William H. King submitted Resolution 319 to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee demanding that the looted gold be set aside in trust for the Armenians. I'm just going to quote briefly.
Wow, I didn't know that.
The resolution stated, quote, the Turkish government had arbitrarily seized and transferred to the Turkish treasury all bank accounts, both current and deposit, belonging to Armenians, by which Armenian gold in the sum of 5 million Turkish pounds, amounting to $22,450,000 back then, was transferred to the Turkish treasury, which gold was afterwards deposited by the Turkish government at the Reichsbank in Berlin. I guess the bottom line is this gold constitutes just a small portion of the billions of dollars of Armenian assets stolen by Turkey other countries.
But it's interesting that 86 years ago, 1925, when there was this resolution that puts it in a trust, that means it may be held here, but it's essentially in a trust for the Armenian people. And so now this FOIA request may bring it out.
Right. Well, I'm hoping, holding my breath, waiting to see.
Right. But it's important because there's so little attention paid to the Armenian genocide that any way that an angle can be gotten on it and the complicity of a lot of people, apparently now even the United States, the ill-gotten wealth of the Armenian genocide is important to bring out. So thank you, Heidi, and we'll update you probably in another 25 years.
Michael, I heard a rumor. I hope it's not true. Is the Israeli government really monitoring individuals involved in boycott, divest campaigns toward Israel?
Well, we know they're doing that in Israel and Palestine, but what's new about the announcement is they're beginning to do it, or they've probably always done it in the United States and around the world, except this is not just the Israeli government. This is a new unit that's being set up by military intelligence of the IDF or the Israeli Defense Forces. And what they're doing is collecting information about supposedly left-wing organizations abroad that the army sees as aiming to, quote, delegitimize Israel.
Now, wait, Michael, that would count the National Lawyers Guild because we have a boycott and divest campaign.
Heidi, it goes on. The new military intelligence unit will monitor Western groups involved in boycotting Israel, divesting from it, or imposing sanctions on it. The unit will also collect information about groups that attempt to bring war crime or other charges against high-ranking Israeli officials.
CCR.
Center for Constitutional Rights. And examine possible links between such organizations and terror groups.
Uh-oh.
So this is like basically the military intelligence of Israel going all over the world to ferret out any group that has any opposition to Israel and then trying in whatever way to destroy them, obviously.
Ominous.
Then, in addition to military intelligence setting up the special spying unit all over the world, according to the Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, the government of Israel is, quote, launching a public campaign as of this week aimed at stopping the planned International Freedom Flotilla set to sail this spring, which was going to attempt to get into Gaza. So Israel is obviously, and hopefully feeling, under tremendous pressure and now is being forced to respond to what has become a worldwide movement outraged at what has been doing to Palestinians for some 60 years.
The U.S. and allied airstrikes on Libya will have far-reaching geopolitical and economic implications. Libya is among the world's largest oil economies, with nearly 3.5% of all global oil reserves, twice that of the United States. We speak today with Professor Michelle Chasadovsky, who wrote a recent article indicating that this is a war about oil, nothing less.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Delighted to be on the program.
Michelle, I was reading your article on Libya in particular, and I was just so pleased to see something that actually went to what I think is the core of what's going on compared to a lot of liberals, unfortunately, and others just talking about everything else but what might really be going on. And so why don't you talk about your main thesis? The article that I was looked at is called Operation Libya and the Battle for Oil Redrawing Map of Africa. There's a few variations of it. Why don't you tell us what the core of that is?
First of all, I think we have to understand that this is not a humanitarian intervention. It is a carefully planned military operation. Anybody who has a minimal understanding of military planning knows that this deployment took months to prepare and that this was on the drawing board of the Pentagon well before the protest movement in Egypt, Tunisia, and the insurrection in Libya. It is a war theater, and it should be viewed in the context of the broader war theater, namely Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. So what we have is a fourth war theater. It opens up a new area of militarization in North Africa. It has devastating consequences. It's part of a global war. So that has to be understood. The object of coming to the rescue of civilians by bombing with cruise missiles, Tomahawk missiles, and fighter jets is an absurd proposition because this is military hardware which ultimately kills people. And we already have reports from Libya, which have not been acknowledged by the mainstream media, that they are actually bombing hospitals. And they bombed hospitals in Yugoslavia as well. I saw it with my own eyes when I went to Belgrade a year after the bombings. I was there in 2000, and I went to the hospital, the children's hospital that they had bombed. In fact, they said, yes, we did bomb the children's hospital, but we bombed the generator plant, which, of course, disabled the hospital and led to an evacuation. But in fact, what they're doing there is bombing civilian infrastructure. It's the same agenda as the previous war theaters. They have a list of targets, and then they go and they bomb. People have to understand that this whole notion of responsibility to protect is absolute nonsense. These people are involved in war crimes. They have no credibility as far as a humanitarian undertaking is concerned.
I want to unpack a little bit of what you've said. A few things. First, on the humanitarian consideration, one of the things I always think about is why Libya and why not the Ivory Coast? Why not Bahrain, where Saudi Arabia has gone in? Why not the Congo? Why not other places where many people are being killed or attacked? It makes me question the motive of humanitarian, obviously. It should make all of us question it. And what you're saying is not only question it because obviously bombs are falling on civilian infrastructure, and I think just your whole statement makes the whole thing crazy. Well, how could we be bombing to protect people, particularly bombing in the massive way we are? How are they getting away with the fact that this is happening all over the world, but particularly Africa, and somehow they're claiming this is humanitarian?
Well, they're getting away with it because the media is lying through their teeth, because they're spelling disinformation. They're falsifying images which come on the TV screens. They're not even telling us what the nature of this rebellion is.
Yeah, talk about that. That's interesting, because none of us know. I have no idea sitting here.
I think that's something which has to be further investigated. Clearly, there are al-Qaeda elements which have been supported by the CIA. Okay, it's called the Libyan Islamic Fighter Group. It's a banned terrorist organization, but it's an armed group. The irony is that 2 years ago, the Gaddafi government made a deal with the CIA. It was a counterterrorism operation, and they agreed that they would go after these people. But in fact, we know from the history of Al-Qaeda that Al-Qaeda is an intelligence asset, and it can be used precisely to create these conditions of insurrection or insurgency, as occurred in Bosnia and in Kosovo. I mean, all these people were trained in CIA camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but there's evidence in 1998-99 that the Kosovo Liberation Army was linking up with Al-Qaeda units. They sent in people to train them. The same thing happened in the early 90s in Bosnia with the Bosnian Muslim Army, where you had Islamic groups which were covertly supported by U.S. intelligence. I think we have to investigate that area a little bit more, the whole notion of who is behind this insurgency. I'm sure that they know who is behind the insurgency, because there are also indications that U.S. and allied special forces were on the ground right from the beginning.
Oh, that I'm sure of. I'm just sure of that, even without knowing it. I agree.
Well, it was reported. We have evidence that they were British SAS forces.
That's what I read.
From day one. And I suspect that they were there even before day one, because that kind of insurgency was also prepared well in advance. The insurgency is not there to win a civil war. It's there to create a pretext for intervention. And you can see that the insurgency was very poorly organized. They didn't have any, contrary to the KLA in Yugoslavia, where you actually had an armed militia with uniforms and everything. This insurgency seems to be a little bit very divided, very disparate. But there was one very interesting incident which happened right at the beginning, when the British sent in a so-called diplomatic mission, which was made up of seven special SAS, special forces in plain clothes, plus an MI6 agent, and they sent in this as a diplomatic mission. They came in, presumably with a helicopter or something from a warship, and they said they were there to so-called provide assistance to the rebels. Now, the irony is that the rebels actually arrested these guys.
Okay? And I saw that. I remember this incident.
They arrested them, and they said, what are you doing here? We don't want any interference. This is our resistance. It's not yours. So that this diplomatic mission was sent back with much embarrassment. They were sent back. They weren't arrested by the Gaddafi forces, but they were arrested by the opposition. And I suspect this opposition is heavily divided in any event.
That's a good point. I think that's right.
The majority of the population in Libya is against this military adventure. If George W. Bush were to say that Gaddafi is a crazy guy, well, George W. Bush was also a crazy guy. So if the United States were attacked by some foreign power coming to the rescue of people who are against George W. Bush, well, I presume that everybody in America would be against this invasion. Well, it's the same thing. I would suspect the majority of the population in Libya deplore the bombings of their cities, etc., because ultimately this is leading to civilian casualties, precisely the opposite of what they pretend, which is saying, well, we're coming to the rescue of civilians.
Michelle Chesedovsky of Montreal, talk to us about Obama's extravagant assertions that this is a duty of the United States to come to defend innocent civilians. What does that have to do with reality?
Well, it's absolutely a nonsensical statement, particularly coming from Obama. Obama has ordered drone attacks on villages in northern Pakistan. The figures that have come out, these are official figures, that last year 1,000 civilians were killed as a result of drone attacks, U.S. drone attacks, and nobody seems to be concerned that this could be, well, this could also be the object of some kind of humanitarian intervention directed against U.S. military action in that part of the world. Nobody is concerned when 1,400 people are killed in Gaza resulting from an Israeli incursion and bombing and so on. And there we could also apply the notion of responsibility to protect and have a Security Council resolution directed against Israel, but that doesn't happen. Well, the reason it happens with regard to Libya has nothing to do with Gaddafi. It has to do with the fact that Libya has 3.5% of global oil and gas reserves, which are twice those of the United States of America. So imagine that's a tremendous oil and gas. These are tremendous resources. It's oil, it's state oil conglomerate. The national oil company is classified among the 25 largest oil companies in the world. There's tremendous resources. And at the same time, Libya is the gateway to Central Africa. And this particular military action is intended to extend the U.S. sphere of influence into Africa, into North Africa, as well as into Central Africa. And my understanding of this is that this operation is not only directed against the Chinese, who are visibly present in, well, they're present in Libya and they're present in a number of African countries, but they have sizable interests in Libya through cooperation agreements signed with the Libyan government. Their national oil company is present. But I would also say that this is directed against France and Italy. Why is that? Because if you look at what's happening in the world today, particularly in Africa, it's France and Belgium which are being shoved out of Central Africa and West Africa. The U.S. military bases being constructed in Algeria, and essentially the result of this military campaign will be to weaken the role of France in North Africa.
So that's why France is in there trying to lead the forces against Gaddafi, even though the U.S. started off the whole business. But France is playing a significant role, according to France.
The question is whether the leaders of France are acting on behalf of France or on behalf of the United States. I have my doubts. One of the major architects of this undertaking is Alain Juppé, at least the political architect. It's not him as such. He's an instrument. But Alain Juppé, in fact, is one of the few French politicians which has a criminal record. He's known for graft and corruption when he was working for the city of Paris and Jacques Chirac was the mayor. There was a judgment against him. He was prohibited from having even playing a role in politics. He had a prison term. It went to appeal, and now he's back in politics. Okay, so now I'm back in politics. It's like saying, well, take Madoff and then appoint him to the Federal Reserve.
You know, I never really expected the Security Council to vote in favor of the resolution they did. And, of course, it's quite a broad resolution. I mean, you could read it broadly. And you had both China and Russia abstain from the vote when they could have cast a veto and stopped this. And then you had the Arab League, at least ostensibly, give approval of some sort. Of course, the African Union didn't, the African countries. But I was really shocked at Russia and China. I'm trying to figure out what's the story. What happened there?
Well, both these countries are heavily divided. Their politics are heavily divided. There's also a lot of horse trading that takes place. I had the same feeling. I said, well, Russia and China will never accept this resolution. It'll never get through, particularly the way it was worded. If you look historically, they really, in the post-Cold War era, they've never exercised their veto. I suspect that they made a deal with them. In the wake of this military operation, they would be sharing the spoils together with the United States, Britain, and France.
Sharing the oil, in other words.
Sharing the spoils. Well, they must have said, okay, well, we won't touch the interests of the Chinese petroleum companies in Libya in the wake of these air attacks. And I guess, had they exercised their veto, the operation would have been launched in any event. They would have then smeared the Russians and the Chinese by saying that they are siding with Gaddafi, they are complicit in the death of civilians. It would have been a big demonization campaign, and they would have done it in any event.
I think that's right. I think they would have done it in any event.
I think that what happened is that they said, well, listen, we'll make a deal. We're not going to touch the assets of the China National Petroleum Corporation, the CNPC, which has a significant stake. They've got 400 employees in Libya. Well, they had. And then there's another 30,000 workforce of 30,000 in Libya of Chinese workers involved in infrastructure and so on. So Chinese presence is very significant in that country. So that there was horse trading, and there was no doubt horse trading with France. But what is absolutely clear is that France's position in North Africa is going to be weakened as a result of the all these events in the various countries. Of course, the three countries where they have a greater stake is Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Italy has very significant interests in Libya, including this pipeline, this gas pipeline that links Libya to Sicily. And consequently, they have stakes as well. But I suspect this is going to lead to a consolidation of American interests in Africa. And if you look at the map, you can see that Libya is contiguous to Francophone Africa. It has borders with Niger, and then it's the entry into Central Africa, the Darfur region of Sudan, and so on. Niger is very important because it has very large reserves of uranium. And as it stands at the moment, that uranium is in the hands of a French conglomerate. Their broader interests, I think the conquest of Libya is part of the battle for oil. It's the same logic as the invasion of Iraq. Iraq has 10% of global oil and gas reserves. Libya has 3.5. I estimated that Muslim countries had something of the order of 65 to 75% of global oil reserves, depending on how you run the estimates, so that inevitably that is why we're demonizing Muslims. They happen to inhabit the countries and the land where the oil happens to be.
Two-thirds of the oil.
It's very clear.
Who put our oil under your sand? Michelle, let me ask you this question to go back to the point about hypocrisy that you made earlier. Secretary of Defense Gates went over to Bahrain. The next day, Saudi troops invaded Bahrain and propped up the dictator of Bahrain. And Obama said nothing about that. And they're slaughtering this uprising, a democratic uprising in that country, which happens to be the place that houses one of the American naval fleets. Can you contrast that to the humanitarian verbiage about Libya?
Well, absolutely. But there's something even more serious about Bahrain. We have a correspondent in Bahrain, Finian Cunningham, who writes for us and also for the Irish Times. And he reported that they're using nerve gas against the protesters.
Wow.
They're using prohibited Amazing. Chemical weapons. He's going to come up with a report. He's reported on it, but he's talked to doctors. He's looked at the whole situation. And he said that coincided with Robert Gates' visit. And then he said another thing, which is very, I think, very significant, they're also using the same chemical weapons in Yemen against. These are people who are involved in peaceful protest. In Libya, this is an armed insurrection. It's not a peaceful protest. Yeah. It's an armed insurrection by people with guns and shoulder missiles.
And tanks, and in one case, a warship.
Let's say the state of Texas decides to secede from the Union.
We wouldn't oppose that.
They can join you up there in Canada.
Right. No, let's say that happens and they have weapons and so on. They're not going to send them tear gas. So, you know, they'll shoot on them, obviously.
Michelle Chedrasi, you have a wonderful website. Will you give it to our listeners, please?
It's globalresearch.ca. We're based in Montreal. We certainly encourage people to visit our site. We've got publications as well, books. We don't represent any particular political spectrum. There's very broad readership, and also the contributors are from a very broad range of perspectives. But we try to be factual and analytical and back up our facts. We're not publishing things which are not backed up by solid information. Again, please visit our site, globalresearch.ca.
Michelle Chedrasi, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michelle. It was great and really refreshing to talk to you, considering what the verbiage and garbage we're hearing all around the United States.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In what is a nationwide problem, unemployment in a jobless economic recovery has hit young African-American men the hardest, according to a recent report by the Community Service Society. The highest unemployment rate in 2009 was among men 16 to 24 years of age. Their overall unemployment rate hit nearly 25% during the recession. Breaking it down by race, young black men had the highest unemployment rate in this group at 33.5%. While only one in four black men ages 16 to 24 has a job in the city, that figure drops to an astounding 1 in 10 for young black men without a high school diploma. The recession has created a landscape of the unemployed and underemployed with particular catastrophic consequences for young African-American men, said David R. Jones, president and CEO of the Community Service Society of New York. Quote, "We have long known the struggles of the more than 200,000 youth in New York City who are out of work and out of school. Now, young black men between 16 and 24 years of age have become the banner of hopelessness, particularly here in New York City." David Jones joins us today. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We know that Community Service Society over the years has done some really in-depth reports linked to poverty in New York City, but we were rather stunned to see the statistics in your most recent report on unemployment in New York City during the recession and early recovery.
Right.
Startling that young black men from the ages of 16 to 24, I believe only one in four has a job?
Yeah, and that's an employment ratio. Essentially, the unemployment rate for black men 16 to 24 is 33.5%, which is incredible.
That's astounding. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge number.
But then you dig in, unemployment rate only counts people who are actively seeking work. So for those who have never made the connection to work, or those who have just ceased trying, or those who may be in some level of education, you know, the numbers drop to just one in four are actually in the workforce. And that really spells some real dangers for the city of New York. And we think it's indicative of other major cities as well.
Right. That's a good question. First of all, what numbers are we talking about? One in four, I understand. But is that 1,000, 10,000? How many people
are
in
the cohort? No, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of the people involved here. Obviously, African Americans, I believe, constitute about a third of New Yorkers, or thereabouts, 25% to so, and we have about 8.5 to 9 million people here. So the numbers start to go into the hundreds of thousands almost immediately.
Now, what I thought was of note is that the years included are from basically 2006 to 2009,
yeah.
And we went from 5% in 2006 to 9.6%. That's nearly double.
That's the overall unemployment rate. But when you start to look at working-age black men, the rate jumped from 9% in 2006 to nearly 18% in the 2009. We have every indication that because of the depth of the economic problems, that number continues, if we're lucky, increasing or certainly plateauing at that. And that's really not sustainable. I think people have to recognize that this is something totally new. you have to go back to the Great Depression. And in fact, at least anecdotally, the Great Depression didn't have this kind of impact on the black community that this recession is having on them.
I would have been one of the people who would have said, well, yeah, it always hits black people more, of course, because they have lower level jobs. They're not as they don't have the same number of diplomas, et cetera.
But yeah, it's interesting. One of the things, and we have sort of only anecdotal information on this, because New York in the Great Depression was a segregated city. Many of the jobs that African Americans held were either working in exclusively black communities or in trades that were sort of circumscribed. You get everything from Pullman porters to certain kinds of restaurant work, which were the reserve of African Americans before the Civil Rights Movement hit. And in fact, the homeless of New York, certainly when I was growing up in the city and Crown Heights and Bedford-Stuyvesant during the 50s and 60s, there were no black homeless. The homeless of New York were white single men on the Bowery.
Wow, you know, all this stuff is a revelation to the three of us listening.
And so, you know, homelessness was not part of the picture then. I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture for black New York before the Civil Rights Movement. But in fact, the impacts were different. And in fact, there's some indication that what we were seeing on the Bowery during my young adult years was actually the end stages of what happened to a large group of people, white working men, who were dislocated in the Great Depression and never really got back on track. And that's what's got us so worried now. You know, that was a cohort of people who never really got back into the full employment economy. There's indications that New York City actually is confronting a unique problem, more so than most other cities. While we're seeing a better recovery, the number of long-term unemployed is actually greater than New York than in other municipalities, of people out of work from a year to 3 years and more. The trouble is that as you lose connection with the labor market, all sorts of things that are not great start to happen. You lose job skills, you lose hope, all sorts of connections you have with family, friends, employment start to disintegrate. For young people, it's particularly pernicious. The literature seems to indicate that if you really haven't made a successful connection with the labor market by 25, that you're going to be suffering limited attachment to the labor force for the rest of your life. So I'm looking at a problem that we're having this enormous cohort of hundreds of thousands of young people, overwhelmingly at African American and Latino, particularly men, who are not getting jobs, who are becoming chronically unemployed, and marching through their adult years without labor market connection. And we just haven't seen that before.
David, I think there's a perception that, well, education will help with job opportunities. And I was in the report noting that those with some college or an associate's degree actually had the largest absolute increase in unemployment from 4.7 in 2006 to 11% in 2009.
One of the unhappy stories about some of our recent reports, we did a report some years ago on security guards, actually, and I went back to look at it. There are 63,000 security guards in the city of New York when our report was done. Virtually none of them are unionized, and their average wage was about $10 an hour. No health insurance, no paid sick leave.
And not much training either.
Not much training either. I think what we started to become concerned with, particularly after there was a New York Times editorial by Krugman, raising the question of whether even the college educated are getting higher paying jobs. I went back to that report and found that nearly 40% of the security guards had either a BA or some college.
I knew you were going to say that. That's astounding.
Yeah.
And that really spells, what are we doing here? And I don't want to only limit it to New York or even only African-American and Latinos. This is really dangerous here, that suddenly the assumption was you get college, you get an associate's degree, and suddenly you're going to be on the pathway to becoming middle class. Well, I think that's fast coming apart. If that's so, it puts particularly young people without a credential, without a high school diploma, at totally disadvantaged. I mean, the anecdotal joke that baristas, they only hire baristas now at Starbucks if they have a couple of years of college. And as a matter of fact, you can do your own informal survey and ask what your barista, who's pumping the latte out, what their educational background is. Almost invariably well beyond high school. And that's putting a whole generation of young people who either were shoved out or dropped out or ran into trouble in their education at an extraordinary disadvantage, almost unparalleled in places even like New York. I mean, to drop out of high school in the 1950s and 60s was not the end of the road by any means. I think one of our outgoing chairmen and executives of Con Edison, our big utility, didn't graduate high school. But you could drop out and work hard with your company, and you can move up through the ranks and do just fine. Suddenly, you know, that's not enough. An associate's degree may not be enough, and even a BA may not be enough if it doesn't provide the appropriate skill set to participate in a very tough economy.
David, I know that CSS has focused on the issue of so-called disconnected youth.
Right.
And you did a report in 2004, A Crisis of Black Male Employment. How does this fit into the overall mission of what CSS has done? And I know you're one of the oldest social service organizations in the country.
Well, from the very beginning, we're 164 years old. And the joke is that, you know, I may have been here.
David, you have been there a while, David.
Yeah, I
know that.
I mean, you know, but I think the question really became and came out of those reports. We started to reshape our entire agenda built out of those reports on black male unemployment and disconnected youth and security guards, and focused really on the issue of how people make the transition from school to work or from not working to work, and then how do you support employees who are trapped in low-wage jobs in terms of supporting benefits. And the reason this transformation took place for us is basically welfare reform had the impact of essentially turning the only way out of poverty into one of work. Work was the only way to safeguard yourself and your family. That in its wisdom, which many of us thought was much too extensive, they stripped most benefits away from people and left them either sink or swim based upon the ability to get work. So we've been focusing on, okay, these are the rules of the game, and New York has an enormously high concentration of working poor. We've been focusing all our efforts in terms of how we deal with poverty on the issue of this nexus between work and getting people to the position where they can support themselves and families. We did this basically strategically because we think that's the only thing that has sort of across-the-board resonance, but also the reality that with the cutbacks in various kinds of support programs, that people were not going to be able to sustain themselves with very limited government support, even if you were badly in need of support.
What kind of response have you had to this recent report?
Well, you know, I think it's been picked up in both local and national media. The difficulty we're running into, I think, policymakers, because we're obviously confronting a real wave of sort of conservative reaction that, well, yeah, that's really terrible, but we don't have any money to do anything about it. So we are going to cut back. For instance, New York is slated to cut back its summer youth employment program, which is sort of the stopgap jobs program for the very young, for young adults, from last summer's 53,000 to 18,000 this summer. The programs in AmeriCorps and other support programs for young people trying to make the transition into work have, at least in the House appropriations, been totally eliminated. So we are dealing with an uphill battle. I think I don't want to be Pollyanna about this. One of the benefits of what we're looking at, however, is this is not limited to the South Bronx or Brownsville or Mayo Crown Heights. This is a national phenomenon.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted you to address a little of that. You've mentioned it a few times that while you have the statistical evidence for New York, and they're really shocking, you said that you think this is across the country as well.
Well, we know when we did our report on disconnected youth, while we had nearly 200,000 disconnected youth in New York, there were nearly 5 million disconnected youth scattered across the country before the recession. That, it turned out, confine itself only into inner city neighborhoods. This is a problem of suburban communities, of rural communities all across America, where many young people, particularly with no credential, are running into the problem that there is no place for them. You go out in parts of New York State, and basically, for a high school dropout, I don't care of whatever color, finding a job has become a major crisis. And I think one way or the other, how quickly we do it will obviously have an impact on how much suffering we go through. But the country is going to have to grapple with this. We're looking like, and most of the economists I talk to, we're never going to go back, or at least not in the rest of my career, to the unemployment levels, which we found unacceptable in New York, up 5% again. That we are going to come down, perhaps, from the 9.6%, 9.5% that we're hovering around now. But it's likely to be somewhat more akin to the European model of very high rates of unemployment, particularly for the unskilled. And whether today or tomorrow or next year, we're going to have to come as a country. What do you do for young people who are not prepared to participate in the economy, not because they're not interested, but they don't have the skill set? And where are you going to go about finding second chances so they can get back into the workforce and start helping themselves individually and starting to create intact families? That's not going to go away. And in some ways, you know, I think part of what both the Democrats and Republicans are missing is part of the anger out there is suddenly you find parents, and I'm being a parent, watching their young people come along and maybe not be on an academic track or sometimes on an academic track and not being able to find the equivalent job or job prospects that they had. And that breeds a lot of anger because we've always saw ourselves, the United States, the richest country on earth, the home for free enterprise, the whole bit. It was always the expectation if you worked really hard, there was going to be a way, you know, sort of a seat at the table here. And suddenly I think more and more people are recognizing, at least for their children, in some cases for themselves, that's not working out.
David, I would imagine that harsher sentencing laws and the problem of mass incarceration is also exacerbating this situation.
There's no question that the 1 in 4 number we have, 1 in 4 black men, 16 to 24, actually being part of the workforce, is partially attributed to high incarceration rates in the state of New York. We have somewhere around 60,000 people incarcerated in the state. It's dropping somewhat. Have about 23,000 on parole, and they don't even keep records of the hundreds of thousands who have a serious criminal record. Now, after you finish prison, I think every research paper we've looked at shows that you're virtually unemployable. That no matter how many years of good conduct after your release, you're basically coming back into the society with an enormously difficult time in trying to get work. You're also coming out of a prison system that has virtually eliminated much of the education supports that were there in a way to try to be tough on crime. So you get substantial portions of the young people and not so young people coming out of prisons with only limited math and reading skills and being dumped not equally across the city or the state, but in the poorest communities of the state, further destabilizing those communities because people inevitably, if they have no visible means of support, start to prey upon the young and the elderly and other vulnerable in the communities they're in. So it's one of the reasons New York State has the fifth highest recidivism rate in the country. We're doing a couple of things. We're making it impossible to get work once you've been incarcerated, and we incarcerate for, you know, things that Jeb Bush's daughter, you know, when they got into trouble with narcotics, it got nothing. They may actually run for office before we're finished at the rate things are going, but a similar crime committed by a youngster in Brownsville could lead to a long sentence, even if it had no violence or anything else attached to it.
You said before things were really getting to be dangerous here, and I wanted to put this in an international context, if I might. David Jones, focus for a second on Tunisia and Egypt. In Egypt, after the American economic crash, the population living on $2 a day or less went from 39% to 43%. in neighboring Tunisia, which kicked things off, the person that started it all was a college graduate who was reduced to selling fruit at a fruit stand and then humiliated by a cop, and he set himself on fire. Is that the kind of danger that we're talking about with these huge populations that are so impoverished that they get desperate?
Well, I think it's two different. Actually, I think those examples are good because I think we have two different trends going on here. There's clearly the anger of the educated. You know, they've done everything right. Gone through high school, they had gotten college credit, got a BA, and suddenly to find that it doesn't work. So we are going to get a group of educated young people who feel betrayed, that's not the deal that they thought was being crafted. And then there's the other group, which is the ones who were failed earlier often with substandard schools. We did a little survey some years ago when I was looking at the distribution of monies for public education throughout the state of New York. And we were very concerned because we found when we did a little survey of high schools in the city of New York that those serving predominantly black and Latino communities had no operating laboratories, while the specialty schools, Stuyvesant, they spent $13 million on the bridge to Stuyvesant alone. When you went to places like Boys and Girls High School, Prospect Heights High School, they literally didn't have people teaching the sciences, which was a requirement. And I said, it's terrible. It must be all black and Latino kids affected. But then we decided to broaden the survey, and we found in many parts of rural New York, they don't have operating systems either. So the question of this whole group of young people who are not being supported because we have this bizarre system, unlike, I think, any other developed country, of using property tax to drive our educational system and letting incredible variations in educational quality persist. We talk about charter schools as sort of the red herring here, but we really, going back to 1977 when Thurgood Marshall and his dissent in the Rodriguez case, there's no constitutionally protected right to equal education. And Thurgood was in the dissent there, and he said, you know, the democracy just took a major blow. And it's playing itself out, because clearly, if you don't get adequately educated here, and a lot of our young people of all sorts are just not getting the kind of tools they need to properly compete in a very difficult world economy. And we seem to be making it worse rather than better. And we're selling people that the solutions are very minor changes, charter schools, vouchers, everything but equalizing school funding. So I'm taking that issue because I do think the cohort of young people who don't have credentials to do anything, if they're lucky, other than get low-wage jobs, is going to be growing by leaps and bounds. And the disaffection that's growing now across America that it's going to have all sorts of negative. It's not going to turn necessarily to democratic movements. It's been pointed out that the explosive growth of methamphetamine use among white youth is probably connected to part of this problem. I think the scapegoating of immigrants that has taken on, you know, a really powerful voice is partially because people want to blame someone for why they can't get employment. All of those kinds of dysfunctions are the countries at risk for.
David, we want to remind listeners the report is Unemployment in New York City During the Recession and Early Recovery. And I should note that Michelle Holder from CSS right. was the author of this report, and it's available on the website.
Yes, it is.
It's been a true honor to talk to you.
Completely remarkable, David, yeah. I have to say. I mean, yeah. I never heard you give that kind of an explanation, but it's quite special. So thank you.
Let's remind our listeners, we've been speaking with David R. Jones. He's the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Community Service Society of New York, CSS. And David, give us your website, would you please?
Yes, it's cssny.org.
Thank you, David.
Okay.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. ¶¶